I'd like to talk to you about something. We had on the air a few weeks ago a gentleman named Bill Katz, and we were talking about black Indians, and it was so popular, I got so many calls on it, I decided to ask him to come back. Because I don't know how many of you know this, but there, and this is not talked about, it, Buckton the Preacher alluded to it, the relationship, the coalition, the unity between black African slaves and Native Americans. We don't hear about it enough. And yet, if you look at the faces of North Carolinians, if you look at the faces of most black people, you will see Native American features. Now, there are some of you saying, uh-oh, here he goes. He wants, always trying to dilute the blackness. This is not what I'm saying. I'm looking at historical reality. And the historical reality is that 75% of all black folk in this country have Native American blood. Why are we denying that? And it doesn't matter whether you're Cherokee, Choctaw, Seminole, Creek, Crow, Osage, Cheyenne, or Sioux. You've got it. Now the question is, how did that happen? And with us to discuss this is Bill Katz. How are you, Bill?
Okay. How are you, Felipe?
Listen, I am fired up and ready to go.
Okay.
Fired up and ready to go. One of the things I wanted to ask about is the African leadership of some of these tribes. There were black Indians in the United States who actually led Native American tribes. Can you talk about that, Bill?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples. Jim Beckwith was a man of African descent, and he was an indentured servant. He escaped in the 1820s, and he soon became a leader in the Crow Nation. That's a clear example. Let me go back even further to a woman, since this is Women's History Month, Felipa Maria Arana.
I like her already.
Where do you hear? In the 17th century, she's leading a Maroon colony in northeastern Brazil.
Mm.
And she's leading it so effectively that she not only defeats the Portuguese armies repeatedly, but she wins from the Portuguese. They can't defeat her. So she wins sovereignty, freedom for her people, and even trade relations.
And she was from the United States?
No, she was not. No, she was in Brazil.
Okay. I often talk to Mexicans about this. I did a speech at North Carolina AT&T, and I said to the Mexican students there, because there's this kind of a friction between the Mexican immigrants coming into the South and many of the black American folks who are there who have businesses, I said we had to discuss ways of looking at each other in more compassionate ways. Nobody's taking your job. But the Mexicans, I noticed there was a certain stiffness, and I said, I don't know why y'all are being stiff when so many of you are black. My God, Bill, it was as if I had shot them through the head with a 9mm. I said, oh, no, and I showed them your book.
Mm-hmm.
They went crazy. They loved it. They started looking. I said, look at your skin color. Do you think that this comes from your being Spanish? Are you serious? And, of course, that we began to discuss the fact that Africa, in many cases, there were more Africans in Mexico than there were Spaniards. And that was the reality. And so when we speak about black Latino mixtures, and we include Native American with that, we're talking about a history that's real. What were there laws passed against this black Indian relationship by the United States?
Well, there was a terrified response by, first of all the colonial powers, including the Spanish in Mexico. They passed a law, actually a law very early on, Cortez, going back to Cortez and the conquistadors, forbidding blacks and Indians to live in the same villages.
They were scared, huh?
They were saying, well, look what you get later on. You get Vicente Guerrero, the black Indian president of Mexico in 1829. He becomes both the George Washington and the Abraham Lincoln of Mexico because he declares independence, he frees the slaves, he ends the death penalty, and he calls for an end to discrimination.
Let me make it also clear to our listeners that the Guerrero Initiative finally resulted in the Battle of the Alamo. The Alamo was fought over slavery. I don't know why they don't talk about this. Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, both, by the way, convicted pedophiles and rapists, who ran to the Alamo to get away from that. But having said that, Mexico told the Texans in the Alamo, we do not want slavery in our territories. We've abolished slavery as a result of the Guerrero move.
Yes.
And the Texans said, well, we will do what we want to. We're leasing the land. The Mexican government said, we are the landlords. And if we don't want you to have that, and that was stipulated before you took it, you knew that we were against slavery. The Texans revolted against it. And that's why Mexicans went there under Santa Anna and destroyed the Alamo. Now, we see it as a major move against the United States government. When in fact, what they were doing is saying, we do not want you to have black people as chattel slaves in our territories. And that was it. And the United States, as usual, well, I leased the land, I rented, so now I own it. And that's basically what happened as a result of the Guerrero move. Tell us a little bit about Cohia, John Horse.
Well, John Horse was, along with Wildcat, they were leaders of the Seminole Nation in Florida, and they joined up when they were both young men and met there, and they conducted a resistance against the United States incursions into Florida, and they fought that from 1816 to 1858, and rather successfully, and then they agreed to move out west. They went to Oklahoma, and then they finally went into Mexico in 1850, as the Civil War was heating up and there were attempts to raid their nation, actually to capture the black members like John Horse. And they set up in Mexico, and for, I think, let's see, it was 1850, it was about, for 15 years, their young men, who by then were superb desert fighters, the greatest this country has ever seen, patrolled the Rio Grande border for the Mexican government. And then when the Civil War was over, they came back and into Texas, crossed into, actually, it was the only instance in all history where a black nation crossed into the United States by invitation, led by its reigning monarch, John Horse. Right. This is unbelievable. This was July 4th, 1870, the exact date, should be celebrated. And they set up camp there in a couple of the forts, Fort Duncan, in Texas, and the young men served as scouts for the U.S. Army because the Comanches and the Apaches and everybody else were running circles around them.
Right. Now that we've talked about the East, the Seminoles, the Crees, the Cherokees, let's get a little bit into the Western side of it, and blacks and Native Americans getting together, the Chippewas, the Sioux, the Osage, the Crow. There was a gentleman named Edward Rose. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, he was a fur trapper, and he was one of a whole group, like Jim Beckwith, I mentioned previously, who got along so famously with the Native Americans that they were often hired by white fur trading companies, the Ashley Company and so on, and to actually negotiate with the Native Americans and deal with them. Matter of fact, one famous explorer said, the old fur trappers always got a Negro, if possible, to negotiate for them with the Indians. They could handle them better with less friction, and that's a direct quote.
That's a direct quote. And, by the way, Rose was one of the best experts in the wilderness. And they say he was thick-set, according to your book. He was thick-set. Grim, serious look, they said. Had a slash on his nose. In fact, they used to call him Cut Nose.
That's right.
And he came from ancestors that included Cherokees and Africans. He spoke, they say, a dozen Native American languages, an Indian Sign Language.
Well, you know, that's an important. I want to pause on that for a moment, because it seemed that one of the first things the Africans did when they got near the frontier, much more than the whites, is they learned the native languages.
Mm.
And there's a whole history of the explorers going back to Columbus using Africans as translators because they picked up these languages much faster than the Europeans. I think, first of all, they were more interested and less prejudiced.
And also maybe their dialect. Remember, the English language, though the Spanish also is adept at this, has a vowel. The Africans probably had to do it. I mean, sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. You're in trouble, you better learn some languages. I would hope that young black kids would do that here.
Yeah.
That we would learn another language. Having said that, I know that several of the cities in America were founded by black men like Rose and several others who would lead these expeditions whether it was Detroit, whether it was Chicago, whether it was L.A., and literally found cities. Of course, we don't like to say that these were black men who found them, but it's true. This gentleman, Rose, also he served as interpreter, you say here, for Wilson Hunt when he led Astor's men to Western lands. They say that he became a Crow chief at one point in his career.
Yes.
Tell us about that. He lived among various American Indian tribes, understood their languages, developed trusting relationships.
Yeah. No, see, that's the point. And by the way, one of the towns that was founded was Boley, in Oklahoma, and was founded by a black Cherokee woman out there, and it became one of the 32 self-governing black towns that existed in Oklahoma between 1890 and 1910. That's a whole phase of our history left out. It's alluded to in the movie Posse, if you saw that.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, they're in a black town and people trying to get an education, and that went on there. But because when the Oklahoma Territory was opened to settlement in 1889, 100,000 people had lined up, 10,000, it turned out, were African Americans.
Whoa! And, are you serious?
Oh yeah, and they were the ones that raced the land on horses, on feet, and carrying the kids in baby carriages.
You never see that on TV.
Exactly.
Now this, you write about the Black Chippewas, and how many of them arrived in Minnesota long before, almost 50 years before Europeans did.
Yeah. Well, what we have to understand is that the Africans, being enslaved, were trying to escape. So they become just automatically, where can they head for freedom? Well, the easiest place to get freedom, if you can get there, is the West, because it's largely unexplored. Nobody checks your passport. You know, it's that kind of thing. So, and also, of course, they're being accepted into Native American nations, because many of them by this point are mixed with Native Americans, who your listeners may not know, were the first people enslaved in the Americas. It wasn't Africans. It was Native Americans.
That's right.
And Africans were fed into that system. So by the time they're escaping, they're being aided by their Native American brothers, sisters, fathers, aunts, uncles, and loved ones.
That is amazing. I'm going through the book, and I'm looking at George Bonga.
Right. Now, see, you know, when I was a kid, we used to go to these cowboy movies on Saturday up at the RKO 23rd Street.
Yeah.
It's not there anymore, of course. And for 11 cents, we'd see three cowboy movies. And whenever they showed fur trappers, they always had names like McTavish or McIntosh or Shurum Bonneau. In other words, they were always Scotch-Irish or French.
Yeah, yeah.
But they never looked like the Bonga brothers.
The Bonga brothers are very, very dark.
They are very. Matter of fact, one of them used to joke, he used to tell his friends, I was the first white man in this country.
That's right.
Have a good laugh.
Everybody, in the quote you say, I assure you that John Bonfield and myself were the first two white men ever came to this country, Bonfield being one of his partners. They say to amuse his guest, Bonga, an African slave who became married a Chippewa woman and became a noted fur trapper, he assembled a crew for an early day's lake voyage, complete with a splendid birch bark canoe manned by 12 hardy men, and led by Bonga, and to the music of French Canadians. This judge that went along with them, learned how royally they would travel when Minnesota was a wild country. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, yes. And he actually, George Bonga, negotiated an important treaty for Governor Lewis Cass of the territory back in those days.
Now,
and actually, if I can add just one other thing.
Sure.
I was out in Minnesota a few years ago, and I went to the Historical Society, and I came up with a photograph in their archives that was 100 years later, after that picture you're looking at of George Bonga and his brother Stephen, and it showed a group of fur trappers. And clearly on the two sides of this group of about eight people were Bonga brothers. So they were still there, still doing their thing.
Years after, centuries after. There's also a man named James Beckwith, who you had mentioned before. And James Beckwith also married Indian woman, you say sometimes in dizzyingly rapid succession.
Yes.
Brothers. But with his flaming temper and love of battle, he kept burning his bridges down, which means they would tell him to get out. Sounds like half the Puerto Rican guys I know. Beckwith became a chieftain of both Crow and Blackfoot Indian nations, so he enjoyed many supporters and admirers. You say that Beckwith emerges from the fur trade's early history as the greatest Indian fighter of his generation. This was an age when his competitors for this honor were Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Jim Bridges, or Jim Bridger, and Kit Carson.
Yep.
You say it's difficult to imagine that this famed frontiersman, his name is James Beckwith, an explorer, had faded from the story of the Old West, but fade he did. In skill, accomplishment, and violence, he matched men whose deeds have become part of a glorious frontier heritage. But when Universal International, the movie company in Hollywood, produced the horse opera Tomahawk, it cast white actor Jack Oakey, I remember Jack Oakey,
Jim
Beckwith. Generations of young people never learned that this tough pioneer fur trapper was a black man.
Yes.
That was a 1951 movie, Tomahawk. I remember that. He was born 1798 to a black slave and her white master. As a teenager, he apprenticed to a blacksmith. And his Western adventures, you say, began with the punch. What happened there?
Well, he was an independent kind of soul, and he was trying to date somebody, and his owner or master there in the indenture system said, "You can't do that." He said, "Oh, well, I'm leaving." And he punched him in the mouth and just headed west and out of St. Louis and just was never seen again. But he was very famous. He was used by the U.S. Army as a scout. He became very important fur trapper. And in 1850, he discovered a pass through the Sierra Nevada mountains that became crucial to the people in the gold rush heading to California from the east. They could go through Beckwith Pass. He even set up a hotel there and kind of settled down for a little bit of time anyway as a hotel owner.
Wow. Beckwith, I'm reading, Beckwith had a few wives, William, just a few.
He did go through them rather rapidly.
All of them were royalty, daughters of chiefs who could do him some good.
Yes.
At one point, he got mad on his wedding night and told his wife not to dance. Clobbered her with the side of an axe, turning to her father. He explained that discipline had to be maintained by the husband. He could not have existed these days. I'll tell you that much.
That's right. He was not the kind of fellow you'd like to sit down and have dinner with.
No, no. And I see a picture of him. He's a big guy. Not someone I'd like to play with. Was there any relationship between African slaves, African Americans, and the Sioux, a people who I love dearly, the Lakota?
Yeah. No, well, they first of all, you have to understand, the Africans, for example, that came with the Spanish expeditions going back to the 1500s,
yes,
that explored, the Africans often peeled off. They left when they could, because they were enslaved and were seeking freedom, and they joined the Native American nations, the Sioux, you know, or the Cheyenne, the groups out there, the Apache, the Cheyenne, and I
have. Can you imagine, William, the Apaches and black people getting together? My God, that must have been fearsome.
Well, my good friend George Tooks was brought up by, he's an African American, he was brought up by his Apache grandmother, and he raves about her when he lectures.
They were so afraid of Apaches in Texas and in Arizona. They were great trackers. They were fierce guerrilla fighters. It was difficult to catch them. Of course, Geronimo was one of their heroes. And Geronimo, as many of you know, was a shaman and believed that he could not be killed. And it never was, by the way. He was captured in battle, and he died of old age. But what an amazing leader. And the way he led his tribe, it was unbelievable to me. And when I read about him, I'm always amazed by his ability to dream, his ability to concretize his dreams and lead his people to battle. We were talking about the Sioux. What you're saying that after...
Well, let me go back to another Apache that nobody's ever heard of, a black man named Cato, who back in around the late 1860s commands two dozen Apaches near Fort Belknap, Texas, and they attack the Leadbetter Salt Works. He's wounded. His band is driven off, but he's spreading a lot of discomfort among the white people of Texas. And next year, you got another black man leading an Apache attack, shouting orders from a large rock out of rifle range. And there's a lot of this mixture. It's hard to find this information, but it's there. It's part of our tradition. It's part of our freedom-fighting tradition.
Where do you get all this stuff? How do you research it?
Well, a lot has surfaced. I was lucky enough to know the historian Kenneth Wiggins Porter, who died many years ago. And he was fascinated by this subject. And he was writing articles about it when Herbert Hoover was the great white father in the White House, way back, you know, during the Depression times. And his works have this, and his footnotes lead you to other sources. And I've, you know, visited, you know, other historical places and, you know, gotten this from museums. Actually, some of it has even been sent to me by librarians at Western museums.
Wow. Do you think maybe you could teach a course? Have you thought of teaching a course in college?
I have thought of it, but I've mainly concentrated on my writing.
Wow. Well, thank you, Bill.
Actually, I'm going to, could I just mention,
I'm
going to be giving some lectures on Black Indians to those that want to see my PowerPoint lectures this coming Wednesday at the Breck Forum. I'm going to be there at 7:30 talking and showing my pictures on Black Indians. And the next day, I'm going to be at the Langston Hughes branch of the Queens Public Library out in Corona at 6:30. That's on that Thursday of next week.
Thank you very much, Bill Katz.
Great being on with you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for coming on at such short notice and changing. I was going to put you on at 7:30, but I had to change it because some of our friends in California had to get up fairly early. I thank you, Bill Katz. Stella, I love you.
Yeah, Stella sends you her regards.
Well, that's my baby. That's my baby. I'm her. She calls me her nephew. But you know, I was always in love with Stella, and she would come into the radio station.
We all are.
She would come to the radio station at when I was at another at WRVR. I'd say, Stella, please, can we just go out? She would just smack me in the back of the head. She'd continue playing records and stop it. I love her. God bless you, Bill Katz. What is your website, Bill?
Oh, it's WilliamLKatz.com, and people can read my large essay there free of charge on Black Indians, my one on the Black West, and, you know, find out about my 40 books.
All right. Black Indians by William Lauren Katz is a book that's right now under Athenaeum Press, A-T-H-E-N-E-U-M. Athenaeum Press is called Black Indians. It's William Katz. The book is subtitled A Hidden Heritage. 726 in the city. My name is Felipe Luciano. Thank you, Billy.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. This is WBAI in New York. My name is